The Mock Steel Revolution, a series of lectures on revolution. This week, the theory of evolution.
When I was at junior school in the 1960s, every morning I had to sing hymns. Had to. And some days, to ease the boredom, you might just go... Burr, 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 burr. And somehow the teachers know that you're the one not singing, and they come stomping down your line and grab hold of your arm and go, sing! Just, oh, Lord God, who made everything? Oh, we're just crap compared to you. I don't know how you put up with us. We're not even grateful. We deserve a good hiding. And the man who made it possible for us to sing these hymns but grow up not believing a word of them was Charles Darwin. And yet what most of us are taught about Darwin comes down to one phrase, survival of the fittest. The philosophy of people who lead local branches of the Conservative Party. That it's natural that the people who end up on top are the strongest and fittest and most powerful, which is why the people they've argued should be running the country have been John Major, William Hague and Prince Charles. Whereas Gary Wilding, in my class at school, lived in a caravan, and he could have taken all three of them out without looking up from nicking a trench. In this programme, I will be arguing that survival of the fittest is the very opposite of what Darwin believed, and that the main reason that the Victorian establishment was terrified of his theories was not, for the most part, religion. Darwin, grandson of industrialist Josiah Wedgwood, esteemed president of the British Geological Society, wealthy shareholder, valued member of the Whig Party, and yet the children's book about him by Anna Sproul begins...
Charles Darwin was one of the world's great revolutionaries, and his book, Origin of Species, was a formula for revolution.
So before Darwin, what did most people believe about the history of Earth and its inhabitants? Well, at the beginning of the 19th century, belief in the account given in Genesis was still widespread. The most literal creationists believed that two great events had shaped the earth, the creation itself and then the flood, when, according to chapter 6 of Genesis...
The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on earth had become. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind, whom I have created, from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground, and the birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them.
Which was a bit rough on the other animals, wasn't it? They must have been thinking, well, why take it out on us, you vicious sod? We can't help it if man's wicked, we're starfish. So most people believe that the Earth was only a few thousand years old. A vice-chancellor of Cambridge University made a pronouncement that...
Man was created by the Trinity on October the 23rd, 4004 BC at 9 o'clock in the morning.
I suppose that was so that when God finished, he could go, ah, good, just in time for can't cook, won't cook. There was a social reason for believing in the creation story. In feudal society, it fitted the picture of a universe in which everything and everyone had their God-given place. Based around the ideas of Aristotle, the prevailing idea was that rulers were born to rule, administers to administer, and the rest of us just to serve. So it's not hard to see why Aristotle was popular amongst the nobility. For example, he wrote...
Even the bodies of men prove that some are born to rule and others to labour. The upright carriage of the noble renders him unfit for servile work.
Well, Skive! I'd love to help mow the lawn, but I'm afraid I'm too posh. It's the upright carriage, you see. Most important of all in this picture, nothing ever changed. By the 19th century, with rapid changes in technology, travel and science, belief in the Bible's version of creation was being undermined. The geologist Charles Lyell proved that the Earth was much older than 4,004 years and calculated that it was nearer to 300,000 years old. And the discovery of fossils of animals which no longer existed presented another problem. So theories were advanced that God may have staged more than one creation, occasionally making a few creatures extinct. This theory of a series of creations became the orthodox view in scientific circles in the 1800s, particularly with a Dr. McCulloch who argued that if you studied the fossils of extinct animals closely, you could see that their noses are elevated as a result of trying to keep breathing during the flood. And I bet there were some people who went, oh yeah, look at that! Say, and in these ones, you can see from the position of the front legs that they were trying to attract the attention of the Coast Guard. And someone would believe it. The The most influential radical in natural history at this time was Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. He'd written about evolution before Darwin was even born. In his theory, creatures could change themselves through their own habits. So, for example, a giraffe, by stretching to reach tall trees for food, could lengthen its own neck. It would then transfer this to its genes so that it would pass the longer neck onto its offspring until after several generations, the giraffe would have the length of neck it needed. But if this was true, animals could change without God's direct intervention. Lamarck had lived through and been a supporter of the French Revolution, so his theory was in some senses an extension of his bourgeois ideals, that you should be able to achieve your aims through your own efforts rather than just accept the status you're born with. In other words, he imagined the first long-necked giraffe saying to the others, "Hard graft, mate, that's how I got this. Getting up at 5:30 in the morning and do 2 hours neck stretching before a 10-hour shift at a banana tree, mate." Robert Charles Darwin was born in 1809, on the same day as Abraham Lincoln. He was brought up as part of a wealthy medical family in Shrewsbury, where he was privately educated before going to Edinburgh University to study medicine. Darwin hated his studies and he left without a degree. For a while he spent his time obsessively collecting beetles, but then a position was put by for him as a country priest. They do all right, the rich, don't they? Imagine if you were an unemployed labourer going down the job centre.
Well, what are your qualifications?
I left college for me course ending.
I see. And what are your skills?
I collect beetles. I've got 276 different types.
Right. Well, I'm afraid all I can offer you is a job as a priest.
But Darwin did even better than that. A professor who was a friend of his father's got him a job on a 5-year voyage on HMS Beagle. But it's a myth that Darwin's role on this ship was to be the naturalist. Darwin was employed by the captain, Robert Fitzroy, because he wanted someone to talk to on the 5-year voyage. Now, Fitzroy also had a second reason for wanting a companion. He was paranoid that he might end up committing suicide. The previous captain of the Beagle had gone mad on board ship and shot himself. And Fitzroy's uncle was Castlereagh, the foreign secretary who'd gone mad and slit his own throat. And Fitzroy believed that he may have inherited his uncle's slit-your-own-throat gene. So with a 5-year voyage to negotiate, Fitzroy invited Darwin onto the Beagle as someone of a sufficient social standing that he could converse with. Now, to tell the story of Fitzroy, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. Darwin and Fitzroy got on fine. And Darwin eventually took over from the previous ship's naturalist, McCormick, who got the hump and went home. But one night, Darwin and Fitzroy had a row about slavery, Fitzroy being in favour and Darwin vehemently opposed. From then on, they ate in separate quarters and hardly spoke. 20 years later, Fitzroy learnt that Darwin had worked out his theories on evolution from discoveries which he'd made while on board the HMS Beagle. Fitzroy felt racked with guilt at his own role. If he'd never employed Darwin, the world might have been spared, as he saw it, the abomination of evolution. So he started running around the streets of Britain, waving a Bible and screaming, "This is the truth! This is the truth!" Even turning up to disrupt Darwin's lectures by doing the same. And in the end, the guilt drove Fitzroy so mad that he slit his own throat. On the voyage of the Beagle, Darwin collected thousands of specimens of bones and fossils. It was the Galapagos Islands, though, in the Pacific Ocean that made the greatest impression on him. While there, he noticed that on each of the many islands, the giant tortoises were different. In fact, he met a local whose boast was that with one mouthful of cooked tortoise, he could tell you exactly which island it had come from. Eventually, he studied the hundreds of samples of finches that he collected in the Galapagos Islands, and like the tortoises, each one was slightly different depending on which island it had come from. If God had created every species, why would he bother to create a different one for every island, all of which had an identical climate and conditions? Several ideas were now influencing Darwin. He noticed that certain sloth fossils that he collected were entombed with prehistoric animals, while other sloth fossils were entombed with more modern shellfish. So the sloths must have lived in both periods, meaning there can't have been a sudden catastrophe such as a flood, which wiped out all the old creatures at the same time. And I bet the later sloths used to say, "Of course, I remember when it was all pterodactyls around here." He wondered about the creatures he collected with a net from deep in the sea near Tenerife, and wondered why, if God had only created creatures as objects of food and beauty for mankind, did he put things where no one was ever likely to see them? For God to have spent a vast amount of time and resources making creatures in the middle of an ocean would make no more sense than if someone said, let's spend billions of pounds on a giant dome and stick it on a wasteland in Greenwich. At one point, Darwin said,
I cannot be persuaded that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have bothered to design the parasitic wasp with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars.
When Darwin returned to England in 1839, the Whig Party, of which he was a member, had come to power. The Whigs wanted a Britain run according to the ethics of industry, manufacturing and science. And you don't become world leaders in railways, navigation and engineering if your explanation for earthquakes and dinosaur fossils is, oh, well, God moves in mysterious ways. In economics, the Whigs followed the ideas of Adam Smith, who suggested that the economy was best served by intense competition. As a Whig, Darwin approved of the new direction. The changing mood gave him the impetus to search for an answer, using his discoveries on the beagle. What made some species survive while others died out? In any species, he said, each individual is slightly different, but in the same way that every human is different, but we're still all human. But what happens when there's a change in the environment? Suppose, for example, a species eats the leaves of trees in an area where the short trees all die out, leaving only the taller ones. Then only the tallest of the species will be able to eat and live and breed. So after generations, a whole new species will have evolved, much taller than the model it came from, and this process he called natural selection. This theory was different from Lamarck's. For Darwin, creatures didn't change themselves, and it was just a matter of pure chance which were the more suitable for each environment. Survival of the fittest just meant that the survivors were those who were lucky enough to be suited to the local conditions. Because if the natural world developed just by protecting the strongest, by now every single species would be a massive hulk of muscle, wouldn't it? Flamingos would have huge, thick, bulging calf muscles. And the only parrots to survive would be the ones who go, do you want a smack in the beak? Do you want a smack in the beak? As Darwin pieced his theory together, it caused him enormous anxiety. Firstly, he became obsessive. For example, he used a similar method to the one that he'd used to work out natural selection to decide whether or not to get married. He wrote out two columns headed marry and not marry. Under marry was
constant companion and friend in old age. Better than a dog, anyhow. Charms of music and female chit-chat. Intolerable to think of spending one's life like a neuter bee.
Intolerable to think of spending one's life like a neuter bee. A biologist's way of saying, well, at least I'll get me end away on a regular basis. Under not marry was
conversation of clever men at clubs, perhaps quarrelling, not forced to visit relatives.
Which may be why he married his cousin. He thought, well, think of the time I'm saving in visiting relatives. Her relatives are the same as mine. I'm laughing. While courting his cousin, Emma Wedgwood, he even wrote about his sexual arousal in terms of how it fitted in with his theories.
November 27th. Sexual desire made my saliva flow. One's tendency to kiss and almost bite that which one sexually loves is probably connected with flow of saliva, hence the action of mouth and jaws.
He wasn't really a romantic, was he? But Darwin's greatest anxiety was his fear of the consequences of his own theories. Here he was with the key to transforming the understanding of the natural world, and it terrified him. So he refused to publish or even tell anyone about his findings for 20 years. What was he so scared of? Firstly, that he proved that nature changed things by chance. If species were constantly adapting, then nothing could be said to have a natural state, and an idea like this in the 1840s could be extremely dangerous, for the Chartists were demanding universal suffrage, and in 1842 they called the world's first general strike, which paralysed the country. At one demonstration where 150,000 Chartists gathered at Kennington Common to demand the vote, some of Darwin's colleagues decided to protect the museums against revolution. The geologist Andrew Ramsay and the botanist Edward Forbes went to their geological offices in Charing Cross Road armed with truncheons, saying,
we are determined to protect the trilobites.
What did they think this demonstration was about? Did they think Chartist speakers at the rally would make speeches like,
it is bad enough that we are denied the vote, but even worse is the existence of flora and fauna in an office in Charing Cross.
Or did they think that the Chartists would say, hang on, there's 150,000 of us. In these numbers we can get in to see a geological exhibition without paying.
Linked to Darwin's worries about the political implications of natural selection, Darwin was anxious about how it would affect his career. He was a vice president of the Geological Society. Fish and plants had been named after him. He was a major shareholder in railway companies. His social life was exchanging witticisms at dinner parties. Owning up to his blasphemous theories would be like Tim Rice getting up at an MCC dinner and saying, "And by the way, I've decided to join the Iranian Hezbollah militia." So for 20 years he lectured and wrote without ever letting on what he was really thinking. Imagine what it must have been like for the poor bloke. The tiniest incident might have made him panic.
And you, Lady Fothergill, would you care to indulge in the delights of one of our esteemed chocolates?
Oh, indeed, Mr. Darwin, I'd be most honoured. Now let me see. Oh, Jamaica fudge, cherry delight. Ah, marzipan surprise is my natural selection.
Ah! You can't have your natural selection. It'll cause too much trouble. How could a banana world be related to an orange supreme? God made the chocolates.
Eventually, this made him ill. He developed all manner of anxiety-related diseases and at times could only get out of bed for 2 hours a day. So he held a raging fear of breaking with his contemporaries, which in some ways is understandable. Historians and scientists have puzzled for years why this was, but imagine you're in a pub quiz and everyone else on your team says, "Oh, I know the answer to that one. Yeah, that's Burt Lancaster." Yeah. Even if you knew that was wrong, would you have the guts to say, "No, it wasn't, it was Fred Astaire"? Maybe you would, but what then if the quizmaster said, "And the answer is Burt Lancaster," and then everyone in the pub said, "Yep, we got it right then, Burt Lancaster," and then every film critic in the world came in the pub and said, "It was definitely Burt Lancaster," and then Burt Lancaster came in and said, "It was me." Would you still have the guts to go, "No, it was Fred Astaire, and I know because I've got his fossil"? So one of Darwin's other worries was lack of proof. He knew that every little gap in his argument would be torn to pieces. Nonetheless, Darwin continued building up his evidence. He investigated the possibility of instincts being passed on through natural selection by studying bees. It was true that some bees made mathematically perfect honeycombs, but the Mexican bee used a different system, not quite as perfect. Now, either this was because the different bees had evolved in different environments, or the Mexican bees were just thicker. In which case there are probably Tory bees who say,
"We demand a league table of hives so that parents of bees can choose where to send their larvae."
And a few rich Mexican bees send their young to a selective hive in Orpington. After 20 years, Darwin was becoming infuriated. And in addition, the political situation had calmed down immeasurably, so Darwin had much less to fear from the consequences than before. But two other things happened which provoked him into publishing his book. In 1851, his favourite daughter, 10-year-old Annie, died of a fever. This, he said later,
"chimed the final death knell for my Christianity."
Although he still stalled, until 1858, when he received a paper from another natural scientist called Alfred Wallace. For some time, they'd been sending each other fossils through the post. But now Wallace had written a paper expressing almost exactly the same ideas as Darwin, and he wanted Darwin's advice on whether to publish them. Wallace's letter gave Darwin the impetus that he needed. What was the point in protecting the world from his theories now if someone else was going to publish the same ideas anyway? So he wrote back to Wallace and told him that he'd got there first. After all that, Darwin's publisher, John Murray, didn't think the subject was interesting, and one of his advisers said,
"Tell Darwin to concentrate on writing a book about pigeons. Everybody's interested in pigeons."
What a useless advisor he must have been.
"Ah, Dickens, come in. Read the Two Cities thing. There's some good stuff in there. Only, can you play up the pigeon angle?"
Then Murray decided on a title.
"An abstract of an essay on the origin of species and varieties through natural selection."
How did this bloke ever keep his job? "Ah, Miss Bronte, I've got it, a perfect title. A treatise on the ability of certain heights to attain their quantum wotheringness." Eventually called On the Origin of Species, it was published in 1859, and Darwin said that revealing his secret was like confessing a murder. All 1,250 copies sold out on the first day. The clergy did go mad. For example, Darwin's friend Huxley was defending natural selection as a lecture in Oxford in 1860, and Bishop Wilberforce stood up and shouted,
"Tell me, sire,
Is it on your grandmother's or grandfather's side that you are descended from a monkey?
But there were also major scientific objections. Natural selection, if it worked, said the critics, would take hundreds of generations to form a new species, and the Earth hadn't been around long enough for the evolution of all the world's plants and animals. This was where Darwin shocked the scientific world again, with his conclusion of the Earth's age. When Darwin came up with his figure, it was like the Antiques Roadshow.
And how old do you think this Earth is?
Well, as someone said, a million years. I don't know if that's right.
What would you say if I told you that this was made 300 million years ago?
Oh, how much is it worth?
But there was one passage on Origin of Species that more than any other had the creationists howling with laughter. Whales, Darwin realised, were mammals, so must be related to other mammals. So he wrote,
in North America, the black bear has been seen swimming for hours, catching insects like a whale. I can see no difficulty in a race of bears being rendered, by natural selection, more aquatic in their structure and habits, till a creature was produced as monstrous as a whale.
Darwin must have felt like when you say something really stupid at school, and all the other kids are going,
here, that kid said a bear could become a whale. You div.
It must have seemed like he believed in one of those things you get on the Cartoon Network. No one can stop my evil plan, for I am Titanus, half bear, half whale. Where were the fossils of creatures that were halfway between one species and the next, he was asked. In particular, where's the evidence of this whale-bear thing? Right up until the 1980s, creationists like Alan Haywood in his book Creation and Evolution were saying,
Darwinists rarely mention the whale, as it presents them with one of their most insoluble problems.
Until the 1990s, when paleontologists discovered a series of fossils in Pakistan of whales with bear-like features, including Ambulocetus natans, which is Latin for the swimming, walking whale. So it took the evolutionists 130 years, but they found it. It would have been brilliant, though, wouldn't it, to ring up the bloke who discovered it when he got home and say, here, guess what, now I've found a lost page from Darwin that says, I'm convinced there must be a creature which is half llama and half daddy long legs. But there had been one major omission from his book, where humans fitted into the theory of evolution. This, he predicted, would have been too much. But he set out to redress this in The Descent of Man, published in 1871. In The Descent of Man, he set out to prove the similarities between humans and apes. To start with, he cited the case of a man called Braham, who had given baboons bowls of strong beer and observed them drunk. He said,
on the following morning, they were cross and dismal. They held their aching heads with both hands and wore a most pitiable expression.
But did he watch them while they were drunk to see if they went up the jungle going, I'll have a large banana with extra chilli? Well, their mate was going, oh, I'm busting. Oh, yeah, I'll go here next to these lions. He showed how closely human embryos resembled the embryos of animals. And to those who protested that we couldn't be linked to apes because they're so much hairier, he showed how the hair on humans' arms converges towards the elbow in an identical way to the hair on gorillas and chimpanzees. So at one point he wrote,
we do not know whether man is descended from the chimpanzee or the gorilla.
Which in 1871, in some circles, must have been like a teenage girl saying, Dad, I'm not sure whether to go and live with a gang of Hell's Angels or Bill Wyman. Towards the end of Darwin's life, a layer of scientists emerged who sought to use or to misuse Darwin to prove that survival of the fittest applied to human society, and that some humans, for example blacks and criminals, were born inferior. This group included Cesare Lombroso, who argued that people who inherited the urge to be criminals also inherited the urge to get tattoos. Francis Galton, another of Darwin's cousins and prominent scientists, claimed to have used natural selection to prove something else.
I have compiled a beauty data. By classifying the girls I passed in streets as attractive, indifferent, or repellent. I found London to rank the highest for beauty, Aberdeen lowest.
A remark which caused him to be kicked off the board of Aberdeen Football Club. Followed the theories of Etienne Serre, a famous French biologist who argued that black people's navels were higher on their stomach than that of whites, which proved that they were more childlike and less intelligent. And Gustave Le Bon, admired as the founder of social psychology, wrote in 1879,
"In the most intelligent races, as among the Parisians, women's brains are closer in size to those of gorillas than male human brains. An intelligent woman is possible, but is as unlikely as a gorilla with two heads."
But apart from the fact that these theories were ridiculous, they also had nothing to do with Darwin. His falling out with Fitzroy, remember, had been about slavery. Darwin opposed all those who used the term survival of the fittest as justification for the actions of the powerful in human society. In fact, he argued that one of the ways that humans had survived was by developing a sense of sympathy for the deprived. All these distortions obscure Darwin's genius, which was to look at the same world that every other human in history had looked at and see something completely different, and yet be so right that 160 years later the missing links of his theories are still being found. For example, so accurate was he in his instincts that during one of his arguments with Captain Fitzroy, he said,
"One of you Tories should be put in pickle as a specimen, as you will soon be as rare as the rarest fungi."
And in evolutionary terms, 160 years counts as soon. In April 1882, Darwin died. The evolution revolution is a reminder that nothing is static. There's no right way for anything to be. For long periods, it may seem that nothing will ever change, but under the surface, ideas and habits and activities are slowly being transformed, waiting to burst forth, apparently suddenly, taking everyone by surprise. All the revolutions in this series have been made by people who, for most of their lives, would never have believed that they would ever help to transform society. The washerwomen of Paris, the rioting Stonewall gays, metal workers of Petrograd, Luddites, slaves of the Union Army, and even Charles Darwin. At one point, these were just like the woman next door or the bloke up the pub. So who's to say whether one day the woman next door to you will say, "Could you feed the cat for me for a couple of days, dear? Only I'm popping down to the barricades to set fire to a tank." There could one day be a programme that goes,
"A series of lectures on revolution. This week, the British Revolution."
In which case, one of the first things that the new regime should do is to say that if kids have to sing hymns at school about God creating everything, then they should be honest hymns and mean everything, including the parasitic wasp.
"It lands on caterpillars and eats them from inside. To make sure that the meat's fresh, it keeps the thing alive. All things bright and beautiful, the Lord God made them all."
The Mark Steele Revolution was written and presented by Mark Steele with the help of Carla Mendonca and Martin Heider. The producer was Phil Clark.